Blog Talk Radio.
Barnett and Rick Hunt Radio Show. How are you all today? Our guest Jeff Slate's in the studio with us, and we're so excited. Jeff, welcome.
Thank you.
Hi out there, everybody. Hey, Rick. How are you doing? Hi,
hey.
Angie.
Welcome.
Hey. Hi.
And happy holidays to you both, huh?
Yes, happy holidays.
Same to you.
Jeff, can I ask you, please, if you would just I know that you've got shows planned, and I don't know about you, Rick, but I'd love to hear what the plans are for the Weekend Wilburys in the next couple of months.
Oh, Lord, there's lots of plans. We're actually playing. Yeah. Well, that's why you ask. We're playing this Saturday here in New York City. That'll be our last show of 2015. So it'll be a really fun evening. We're playing our usual, I mean, I think we're playing for about 3.5 hours. That's our schedule. We do a nice, it's an evening of entertainment here at Hill Country. That's our monthly residency. Then in January, we'll pick it back up. There's a Hill Country here in Manhattan. We're going to play there again on the 9th, and then we're going to play out in the Brooklyn location on the 15th. And then, you know, things are sort of fluid. I don't know exactly what's happening, but we'll be playing at the Fest for Beatle Fans here in Rye, New York, in April. And we'll be releasing a new album to coincide with that, with the artwork done by your lovely co-host, Rick Hunt.
Thank you.
Bravo!
Yeah, so, you know, there's lots of things cooking where, you know, like literally in the studio, you know, currently working on the new record. And, you know, as always, as things come up for live shows, they just kind of get added to the schedule, as you do.
Well, can I ask a question, love, about Hill Country, New York?
Yes.
What is the address of that one?
Oh, Lord, you're asking me details here. I'm just the artist. No. It's 30 West 26th Street. And reservations are highly recommended because it is a, it's not a huge venue. So people should call 212-255-4544 if they're going to come down. You know, and if they don't, they can usually find a spot to stand at the bar in the back, or, you know, or just squeeze up front where the people are dancing and being crazy.
Jeff?
Well, yeah. Absolutely. I was excited because I wondered what part of New York it was in. That's wonderful. So West 26th Street.
Yeah,
it's
sort
30.
Of Chelsea area, which I'm sure you know well.
Yep. Yeah. So
Jeff?
That's great.
Jeff?
I didn't want to talk over you. Please go ahead.
Go ahead, Rick.
I just wanted to, for our listeners, could you give us a brief rundown of who's in the band and who plays with you?
Sure. Well, the lineup for Saturday's show is me and Jimmy McElliott on the guitar, Rick Mullen on the bass, and the great Steve Holly on the drums. Steve, you probably know, has played with Joe Cocker and Paul McCartney and Elton John and Ian Hunter and you know, and then, you know, periodically we do shows with that lineup, and Earl Slick joins us on the guitar, which is always great fun. We did a show in October for John Lennon's birthday, and Earl and I did a couple acoustic songs, and then he joined us for the whole second half of the night, which was, you know, about an hour and a half or 2 hours of electric, which was just an unbelievable experience. And in the spring when we play the Beatle Fest, it will be that lineup with, you know, Steve on drums and also Gary Van Syck on bass and Adam Ippolito on keyboards. And those are the guys from John Lennon's Elephant's Memory Band. And a keyboard player named John Corbett will be joining us. He played with John his last live appearance, and he also played with him on Whatever Gets You Through the Night and some other things. So, you know, we try to get some sort of guest stars in periodically to keep it interesting for both the people who come to see us and for us. You know, it's fun to play with new people all the time.
Wow. And also, my understanding is that Earl Slick was on John Lennon's last studio album, Double Fantasy.
He was. He was on Double Fantasy as well as Milk and Honey and Yoko's Season of Glass. So, you know, his roots run deep with John and Yoko and you know, David, of course. So, you know, there's a lot of, you know, he's a sort of New York City legend in his own right. So playing with him is always fun. And he's, you know, I talked about the new album some, and he's a real sort of key figure, a real linchpin in the new songs. He's on, I think there's, I want to say there's 10 or 11 new songs. I think Slick's on 8 of them. So he's a pretty, his guitar playing is plays a pretty significant role in the new recording. So it's exciting. It's just really fun to play with him. He really brings something unique and special to the table every time he picks up the guitar.
I can't wait to hear the new album.
Me too.
Have you titled it yet, the new album?
I have not. I have, you know what? I knew somebody was going to ask me that question sooner or later. I have not titled it yet, and I really have no idea what I'm going to call it. And at some point, I had this funny conversation with Noel Gallagher about 6 months ago where he didn't have a title for his most recent album, and his office called him up and said, look, we've got to put this on iTunes in 3 hours. We need a title. And he called him back like 2.5 hours later, and he just picked a line from a song and used that. So that it may come down to that. I'm not so precious about titles. But I just don't know. I think when you get closer to, you either have an idea right away going into a project, what it means to you and what you want to call it, or it comes to you very late in the game from sort of the lyrics and the feeling of the record once it's together and sequenced, and you have, even when you have a rough mix, you have an idea of kind of what it means to you, and then it's like with naming a kid. You might know right away what you want to name the kid, you know. You might pull it from a book, or it might be like when you look in its eyes, you know what the kid's name is. And I think I'm counting. I have fingers crossed that when I look my baby in its eyes, its title will appear to me. How's that?
That's fabulous.
There's a good title. When I look my baby in the eyes.
That's a long one.
I was just so impressed reading all the various bits and bobs about you that I find great comfort in my friends who are performing all over the place and not allowing anything to stop them. And I got very excited as I was reading about you, the fact that you're recording a lot, and you're touring a lot, and playing lots of live shows, and getting out and about and enjoying yourself with all the other musicians that are part of your legend, you know. Could you tell us or tell me a bit about the badge? I was out of the States when you guys were touring in Europe. And I wondered if you could just tell a little bit about that, because I know you had, what, 4 albums and all kinds of singles and toured the northeastern states. Would you mind, Jeff?
Well, I think, remarkably, we were probably more popular in the UK than and maybe Germany and a little bit Japan than we ever were in the States. You know, as you know, the States is very big and very hard to crack. And I always felt... the audiences, particularly in the UK, were a little more were easier to reach. Maybe it was the style of music. The badge were very. I mean, we were like anybody, like any band, any four-piece band. We were very Beatles inspired. But I think even more than that, the Small Faces and the Kinks and the Who were real kind of touchstones for us. And that music, I think, especially in the late 90s and early 2000s, had a real home and a real audience, not just in America, but certainly in the UK. And you know, I remember people would come to the shows, some of the younger people who were just discovering those bands. And then, you know, I remember really vividly this group of guys staying late to talk to us after a show in London, and they had seen the Small Faces, and they were there to tell us how, you know, we as, you know, 4 New Yorkers reminded them of the Small Faces. And it was really kind of the most remarkable experience. I don't know if it was, I mean, I think for them it was, you know, we were kind of loud and we had a Hammond organ, but also we had a sense of humor on stage. We weren't, It was loose and it was fun, and it wasn't like a pre-programmed show where we did the same songs every night and we did them in the same order and we said the same things to the audience between the songs. It was very loose and it was very kind of audience friendly. It was more like you went to see someone at a loft party or an apartment or something. So maybe that was what spoke to them. But you know, the badge was. You know, I'd had this experience in the late 80s and early 90s as a solo artist, and which culminated with working on some recordings with Pete Townsend. He produced an EP for me, and you know, things kind of took off from there as a solo artist. But you know, you also burn bright and burn out quickly sometimes when you do those things. And I was really, by mid-90s, really just did not want to play live anymore. I wasn't enjoying it anymore. And took a year or two off, maybe, and started toying with the idea of, you know, playing in a band, you know, with other guys who had similar inspirations and who could bring something equal to the table, not just being kind of the solo artist. And that was the beginnings of the badge. You know, I had as you do when you've taken any time off, I had a stack of songs to choose from. And we made our first record, I think it was 97, called Digital Retro. And it was the beginnings of the internet, and it really found a home on the internet. A lot of people bought it via the internet, and you know, it made me feel like I could do this without, I had young kids at the time, without kind of going out on the road and you know, playing live shows all the time. And as the kids got a little older and the badge kind of progressed, I got out on the road a little bit more. And you know, but like any band, the lifespan, I think, of the badge was maybe to 1997 to about 2005 or 6 of the real core unit. And, you know, it was funny when it all kind of came to an end, as bands tend to, you know, like a lifespan of like 7 or 8 years like that is kind of typical. You know, we have a whole album sitting unfinished in, you know, at my studio at home that, you know, maybe one day will get completed, but it you know, it just kind of felt like time to move on, and but I love those songs. I there's some of them I don't miss playing, but there are some of them I really do miss playing, and occasionally even now we still will. You know, some of them have been licensed for like film and TV and things like that, and it's always fun to hear them when they, you know, come up, or it's always nice to get a check for them, or, you know, whatever. They're the gifts that keep on giving. But I have very fond memories of that. I actually just emailed with our old drummer last night and this morning. So it's not as though that project will ever die, because it's such a significant part of kind of my musical history. But by the same token, it felt like, you know, I got kind of recharged by doing a band project, and it felt like time to move on. And then there was a new chapter kind of unfolded. So, you know, it's the badge will never be completely in the past. There's always sort of new things to explore, and I like to work with those guys. And I can certainly imagine doing a single or an EP or something in the future. In the near future, maybe, but for the moment, you know, it's hard enough juggling writing and performing and recording of you know, my own stuff, let alone adding another project to the table. Wow. So that's kind of the story of the badge.
Well,
I have
you.
Well,
you do keep
you.
Yourself busy. With
yeah,
that. I'm sorry,
I do.
Andy.
But you're right, Angie. You know, there's four, I think there's four albums and a greatest hits or two and a bunch of live albums and singles and EPs. And we did when the internet was very new, we gave away a lot of like live stuff for people.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of material out there for people who go looking for it. And, you know, there's not a month that goes by where it's not like a daily thing. I'm not, you know, that well known, but I will get messages fairly regularly from people who, you know, really love that music and saw us live and, you know, have a favorite song or, you know, something is meaningful to them about that band or that time. So, you know, I mean, that's a great thing about music too. You know, everybody has their favorite album. Everybody has their favorite song. An album that I might not love or might remember differently because I was there making it, but somebody comes up to you and says, oh, I love, you know, such and such song. There's a song on our second album calling Generation Mojo called All for Love, which was really written about a friend of mine who passed away and about George Harrison, and has kind of a George Harrison Beatle-y feel to it. And a lot of Beatle fans will come up to me and talk about that song and want to know about that song. And you know, that's not an album I think about much or play very much, but it reminds me that, you know, in any project you do, there's songs that mean something to people and touch them in a real meaningful way. And so you can't just kind of dismiss them as like, oh, well, I'm not really, you know, I'm not a fan of that album, so maybe nobody likes it. Well, there are people out there who like it, and that's the satisfying thing as an artist. What's important or meaningful to me isn't necessarily what's important or meaningful to everybody else.
Yes, absolutely. That's so true. But, you know, I guess where I was going with this is that I noticed doing this research about you and listening to your wonderful music, which was an absolute joy, Jeff, really.
Thanks.
Thank you for sending the tracks, because I had such a great time. And Rick knows this. Once I get the tracks, then I'm all excited and I don't talk to anyone for hours because I'm just listening. But I found a similarity in you with Alan Merrill.
Oh.
You guys do not know, but you designed your careers. I can tell you this now, because doing the research and being a writer, I spend a lot of time weighing research materials. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And
sure.
When he was on the show, And this is a lead-in, too, for your giving us an introduction to the first song, okay? But I wanted to say to you that I'm so impressed with you that you made a life for yourself, a proper life, a proper career. You went all over. You had a great time. You took it easy when the children were young. You designed your career. And for that, Jeff, in any profession, hats off, babe. That's what you try to do.
I certainly heard it via George Harrison, but I think from the Bhagavad Gita, there's preserve and project the image of your choosing. I mean, we all create who we are and are constantly creating and recreating who we are. And I think if you, especially in this day and age, you know, people come up to me all the time and complain they can't get gigs or they can't get people to buy their music or they can't get their songs in film or TV or they can't do, you know, whatever it is that they can't do. And, you know, you always want to nurture those kind of people because they do have something to offer inevitably, but their perception of themselves and their audience is a negative one rather than a positive one. And I think if you decide this is what you want to do and you put yourself out there as someone who is doing it, it becomes who you are, whether or not and I think people will inevitably gravitate toward that. So, you know, all of my favorite artists in throughout history, and you and I, when we were doing the pre-interview, we were talking about Bob Dylan. I think Bob is a perfect example of he goes where he wants to go. He doesn't worry about where the audience is or what they think of it, but he projects an image of somebody who knows precisely what he is doing. And inevitably, we all come around to what, you know, we may be 10 years late. We may be only just appreciating what he did 10 or 20 or 30 years ago. But, you know, he was there first and he kind of led the way. But he knew that if he put it out there in a sort of positive projection, it becomes the next iteration of who Bob Dylan is as an artist. So I think that's all I appreciate the compliment, but I think it's, you know, if you want to be an artist, and, you know, there are certainly people who choose not to be public about the way they do their art, you know, painters, sculptors, even musicians who just work in the studio and kind of put it out there for the world to hear. But I think in this day and age, as a, you know, unless you are an A-level artist, you have to really work your ass off to get people to hear you and to care about what you're doing. But I think once you get them to listen or read or pay attention in any small way, my hope is at least that they come back, that they think, you know, this is something who's doing, like you said, something who's doing something positive. They're not like, I'm not complaining that the music industry doesn't make me the money that it used to 10 years ago. I've found other ways to approach it. So, sure, I do more live shows, or I do, I think more of doing albums as promotional more than as things that will make me money. Or I write for places like Esquire or Rolling Stone or wherever, mm-hmm. because those give me both visibility. They allow me entree into, to work with artists that I know and respect and who like and respect me and trust me as a writer. But that puts me out there as an artist in a certain way that I hope that people will say, oh, this guy's, he's doing something. He cares. He wants to do this. He loves doing what he does. And he's,
that's right.
You know, I think I feel incredibly lucky to be able to do the things I do. And I say that to people all the time, but I do work very, very, very hard at it too.
Yes, you do.
You know, I am the definition of a small business owner. You know, my small business owner is me and my band and my records and my writing. And there's nothing smaller in 2015 than that kind of artistic expression. And yet, if you work hard at it, there is a living to be made doing it.
That's right. Now, would you give us a talk-in on She Was a Princess, Jeff?
Oh, sure. well, she Was a Princess started out as a song a very long time ago. I mean, certainly more than 10 years ago. And when I came to make my first album with, you know, I think this was about 2010, I went to May Pangs, who was John Lennon's girlfriend in the mid-70s and worked for John and Yoko and Apple too. I was at her 60th birthday party here, and a bunch of us, you know, as musicians do, just ended up playing until they turned off the lights, basically. And at some point, everybody looked around and said, wow, this band sounds pretty good. Maybe we should make a record. And it was kind of a joke, but I got the idea in the back of my head, and it turned out, you know, it was Steve Holly, who I mentioned before, who'd played with Wings, and Gary and Adam from John's
Memory Band. By the
Elephant's way,
Steve
Holly
is a big critter in my musical thing because of England.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So every time you say that, I just want to let you know that, yes, I'm very familiar with his drumming.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's just a great drummer. And that's more for I hope you know who he is. I mean, it's more for the audience than for anybody else. But, and so.
I just wanted to say I appreciated you, you know, contextualizing him for the audience. It's so important. We forget they're people we all know, you know. And
right.
For our audience, hopefully, we're retelling the tales that they wouldn't have an opportunity to hear from the people who actually lived through it.
Sure. Who lived them, sure.
Yeah. So back to She Was a Princess.
So, you know, so I sort of looked around the room and thought, wow, you know, this is a pretty – people are right. This is a pretty good little band. So, and somebody took a picture, mm-hmm. and it was on social media, and people were like, oh, what a cool band, you know, that kind of thing. And so I got it in my head, and I booked some studio time and called everybody up and said, hey, I've got a couple of songs. And I didn't. I didn't have a couple of songs, but I said I did, and I had a date, and that kind of put me on the spot to come up with a few songs, and then that kind of developed into making an album. And one of the songs that I knew I wanted to do for that album was She Was a Princess, because it was it felt like, you know, it wasn't a single, you know, kind of song. It wasn't the kind of song that you're going to play at a live show that's going to, like, you know, burn the house down. But by the same token, I was able to get in on the recording. Steve played drums, and Lawrence Juber, who played with him in Wings, played the electric guitar and the solo. I got Gene Parsons from the Byrds played some mandolin and some backing vocals, and I'm trying to remember, maybe some harmonica too, I think. And Adam Ippolito played keyboards, and Gary Van Sai played bass. And it just, you know, it was a song that I knew had potential. But when you put it in the hands of those guys, it just, you know, it takes it to another level, even beyond what I had kind of conceived. So
here we go.
Yeah, okay, great.
Here we go.
Thing that he wanted to say, but forced as he was proud to obey. It had fallen to pieces, slowly but sure, but not quick enough. She took part of him with her. Faced with his pride on his sleeve like a badge, he'd resorted to name calling. It was sort of sad. Played with a heart and deserved what he got. She thought that he loved her, that he loved her a lot. She was a princess in every respect. He was a pauper. What would you expect? She was a princess, banished him from her court. She was a princess, a real princess.
Wonderful.
That was.
That was lovely.
Amazing.
So that's Birds of Paradox. Is that the first album?
Yes. Yeah. Birds of Paradox is my first solo record. And that was kind of the name of the band because a couple of the guys had played with John Lennon. It's a song of his, Surprise, Surprise, Sweet Bird of Paradox. And because May Pang had introduced us, and that song is about her. So we name the first album Birds of Paradox, you know, kind of a tip of the hat to all those connections. But, you know, and of course it's got that great artwork from Rick Hunt, you know, I'm telling you.
I'll be honest with you, Jeff, I'm more impressed with you than the connections.
Oh, I appreciate that.
You know what I mean?
But I think,
I really don't care about that. I care about what you produced. And what you produced with those guys is absolutely wonderful. It really is. I'm so excited because – oh, no, you're so welcome. I read the I have an issue, you know, with everyone wanting to connect everything with keywords and people that are famous. It makes me nauseous.
Sure.
And so I try not to say anything about it. But every now and again, a promoter or someone will send one something, and it'll be full of that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I just like to clear that away and get to the real stuff. I'm not interested in who they knew or how it came about. The talent is yours, and you were the one who had the initiative to make it happen.
Well,
so,
I think there's no doubt. I think there's no doubt, Angie, that I'm great. I, you know, I mean,
yes,
let's be
yes,
serious.
Yes, absolutely.
So,
you are,
there
Jeff.
There's no doubt.
I'm just trying to give some poor, struggling musicians a little credit where credit is due. You know,
oh,
I like
so
to be magnanimous
sweet.
That way, but I don't.
Yeah.
I never meant to say that I'm not wonderful in my own right. Let's be, you
oh,
know, come
good.
On.
If you don't say it, Jeff, I will.
Now there you go.
Yeah. So now,
but no, I appreciate that. But I and I'm with you. I don't think that it's very relevant. But I do think, you know, it's funny, Angie. It's a double-edged sword because I meet people all the time who have discovered me because of those connections, who wouldn't maybe
yes, I know
be
what
fans
you mean. Yes.
otherwise. And
mm-hmm.
If it's as simple as when the Badge played in London and people came because their friends said, oh, these guys are like the Who. Okay, that's fine. You know, we're not. But if that's what people perceive, then that's cool. And if there's a certain amount of credibility or interest or whatever it is because I surround myself with people who are, you know, have worked with great folks and are great in their own right. I think though the corollary to that is, you know, somebody like, you know, Earl Slick or Steve Holly would not be playing with me if they didn't like the music. You know, if they didn't think that I brought something to the table. So without being egotistical, it's obvious to me when I'm in the studio with those guys or when I'm performing with those guys, it's my job to bring the goods too. And I feel fairly confident that that happens, that, you know, I don't do it 100%
well,
of the time,
be.
But I do my best, you know.
No, you should be, because it's wonderful music. And I particularly liked – okay, kids, I'm going to – just because it's important to do. If you want to understand, this is a quote from a very interesting man, John Friedman, who wrote Dylan's Genius, Forget About Today, biography. And in it,
John is a good and close friend of mine.
Well, that's okay. Is that a disclosure? A disclaimer?
Yeah, well, yeah, sure.
If you want to understand what makes Jeff Slate tick, just watch him perform in concert. It's all you really need to know about him as a band leader, guitarist, and singer. His love of the life and the work comes across in his music. When I caught Jeff at a late-night gig here in New York City last summer, I was reminded once again by the sheer therapeutic power of music to make people happy. That is when the sound is in the hands of someone who loves what he is doing and wants to make a crowd happy. He wasn't mailing it in. He was playing for keeps. Listen to his music. It comes across on his recordings, too. It's called authenticity, which is a rare quality in any field in this digital culture of ours. When you spot it, you know what it is. So many people are content just to get by on flash. So when you watch Jeff play, you know he means it. And I think that's huge praise, particularly from a writer, because they all want to be musicians. And for him to be that generous and that gracious about your talent, that you really have broken down many barriers, Jeff, to get that kind of writing in someone else's biography.
Yeah, it is a beautiful – I hadn't maybe ever read it myself, but having it read to me is, you know, humbling in its own right. It's – you know, I've had nice things and bad things and everything in between written about me, and I don't pay too much attention to them because ultimately you can't. You have to do
That's right.
what you feel is, you know, I mean, I think the music I'm making now that will be on the next album is very, very different than the last one or Birds of Paradox. And yet I think they're all of a piece because they're all me and they're all my expressions, and I think they will still find a home on somebody's shelf or on their hard drive or however it works these days for people who like my music. But I also think you inevitably lose some people along the way and you gain new people along the way. And if I sat every afternoon and read John's quote, I wouldn't ever do anything. I'd think I was great and I would just keep doing – well, no, you would inevitably keep doing the same thing over and over because you wouldn't want to mess with that formula. And I think the trick is to say thank you and to appreciate that that is, humbling to have somebody write and think that. Clearly, in his heart, he feels that. He believed that. But at the same time, you have to march to your own drummer and you have to do, if you want to put – crazy saxophones on a song, you put crazy saxophones on a song.
You don't really
worry about,
yep.
That's
the truth.
What anybody thinks but you.
Okay, now, on that note, let me ask you a question. Sometimes I sound like I'm 12 years old. Could you please talk about Roy Orbison?
What do you want to know? I
in
love
the world.
Yeah,
he's my most favorite songwriter in the world. I love him. And I'm dying to know which songs of his you did live.
Wow. Well,
I can't wait to come and see your show, because when I saw the people whose music you're including in the show, when I read Roy Orbison, I got frisson. I was frissonné. I was standing there thinking, oh, my God, Roy Orbison in the hands of great musicians.
Well, Roy is kind of a fascinating character to me. I think as a kid growing up in the 70s, I remember him being on, it might have been like Merv Griffin or Dinah Shore or, one of those afternoon variety shows. And there are a lot of those musicians who I'm sure did those appearances grudgingly. And yet they, as a young kid, I remember seeing John Lennon and Chuck Berry on the Mike Douglas show one afternoon. They actually co-hosted for a week there in maybe 71
or
2
or 3. Yes, I
remember. I mean, those are some of the guys I play with now. So it's just funny to me that, I remember watching those shows and being – transfixed by John and Chuck Berry and oh my God, Little Richard. I became a lifelong fan. I mean, he was so outrageous and he was so different. He was like this alien on Dinah Shore. I remember it really vividly. But Roy was one of these people who I remember him being, I want to say it was Merv Griffin. I could be wrong. And I remember him doing a song. It was probably Current from maybe his MG. It was probably when he was recording for MGM. And I don't remember the song, but I remember it was this huge, really moving piece of music. And I was totally transfixed by this guy who was, sort of all black with the black glasses and the black guitar. And, he was just like – and then he sat down with – I think it was Merv. And he had the quietest, sweetest voice. It wasn't, expect him to have this kind of larger-than-life personality. And I've kind of spent, as a professional musician, I've interacted with a lot of people who worked with Roy and knew Roy well, and I've also become friends with one of his sons, Alex. And, they talk about him as a real person, and that's always fascinating to me. But they all talk about him whenever he comes up in conversation. Whoever you're asking has a smile on their face. He just sounds like he was this really warm, really funny, sweet character. He had this great – everybody talks about this laugh he had. He had, kind of had this high tenor laugh, this kind of chuckle when he would laugh at something. And, Tom Petty told me this great story once. He was sitting on a couch in the studio – and they were, I think it was when they were making one of the Wilburys records, and Roy was on the couch next to him learning the lyrics for the song before he went into the vocal booth. And he said, he was just sitting there strumming the guitar, and Roy was singing it really quietly to himself to learn the lyrics. And he stopped what he was doing and just listened to him, because it was like this quiet, like he was just singing it to himself. And he said it was like an angel singing. You know, it was like the most perfect voice ever. And
I think
anybody who can do that is you know, who can touch people in such a way that these sort of operatic kind of almost little movies that he wrote as songs transport people to this other place. I mean, that's a real gift that very, very few performers and certainly songwriters have.
Yes. I can't tell you how much I appreciate you sharing that story with us and talking about it. I am so devoted to Roy Orbison. I just, as a child, I had that same experience that you did. I saw him on British TV. He was very feted in Britain, very lauded, very appreciated, always treated with the most respect. But that voice, how could you not? You know what I mean? You're right. That voice just takes you to another place.
Yeah. I mean, you were going to ask, or you asked at the top, you know, what songs we do. We do, because of the Wilburys connection, we do a couple of Wilbury songs. We do You Got It from the Mystery Girl album. We do She's a Mystery to Me from that album. When I used to perform, and still to this day, when I used to perform solo acoustic shows, I used to do Running Scared. And I used to do,
Oh,
and I used to do, and I used to do a song by Elvis Costello called The Comedians, which is kind of an homage to Running Scared. It's sort of Elvis's 90s update of, or 80s update of Running Scared, but they're great songs. And of course, everybody, you know, when you're growing up and you're playing rock and roll in a band, you're playing, you know, Pretty Woman and, you know, all the Uptown and Sweet Dreams Baby and Ooby Dooby.
Yeah,
and, I mean,
ooh,
you know, all
Sweet
these
Dreams
songs.
Baby. Oh, God, that's another one that drives me to distraction.
Yeah, I mean,
his
and I remember.
I want to climb up his voice like a ladder. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The way he drives me crazy. That voice, it's just sheer brilliance, like a star-studded voice.
There's, you know, I recently interviewed Jeff Lynne. I think that was the second or third time I've interviewed him. We always end up talking about Roy because it's somebody we both love. And when you talk about a musician, you know, talk to a musician about music rather than about themselves, they open up a little bit differently. Probably as I am, you know, now talking about Roy, and you know, he talks about Roy and Roy's voice, and Jeff Lynne has worked with, you know, Bob and Tom Petty and George Harrison and the Beatles, you know, all these sort of remarkable people over the course of his career, and he says that bar none, Roy's was the most spectacular voice he's ever heard in person. That it just, you know, he would almost be in tears every time Roy would open his mouth, just because it was so unique and so special and so indicative of the man, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, he left us with a lot of great music. They just released a box set of his MGM years that has, you know, I think there's, God, about 15 albums in there that nobody's heard for a very long time, and one that was never released. So, you know, there's Roy is kind of the gift that keeps on giving, even though he died next week. It will be, you know, the anniversary on, he died on December 8th in 88. So a lot of eights in there. I'm sure there's something numerologist.
Yeah.
A numerologist can figure that out.
Can I ask you another question, Jeff?
Yeah.
Because I'm excited and I don't want to let you slip away without getting all these questions in.
Sure.
I was impressed about your interest and dedication. Please explain it to me, because I am lacking the interest that you have. Explain to me about this Elvis Costello link.
What urged you to cover a whole bunch of songs? I'm fascinated by this.
Well,
because
that
you're such a great songwriter
actually,
yourself.
Yeah. Well, many people have done what you have done and mistake the album for. There's actually only two Elvis songs on the album. The other.
No, I read that. I realized that they were spin-offs, you know, in your own.
Yeah, the other ten
band.
Are mine that are kind of inspired
right.
by. But well, here's the thing. There's a couple of things. I think, you know, I have. Like many songwriters, I have sort of a love-hate relationship with Elvis Costello because some of his stuff I adore to pieces and some of his stuff I find very hard to get into. However, I found myself being inspired by him over the course of my career many, many, many times. And I've written many songs and finished them and thought to myself, you know, it's maybe too Elvis or it's maybe not enough me. Or they just didn't have a place on whatever project I was doing at the moment. So when I finished Birds of Paradise, you know, the Birds of Paradox album took, because there were so many guests on the album, we did it the old way you make an album. We went into real recording studios with real tape machines and real microphones and captured performances. And if they weren't right, we did them again and did them again and did them again. In a way that people don't make records when they make them in their, you know, basements nowadays. So the Birds of Paradox album took over a year to make. And when we finished it, and I knew I was going to start the record I'm working on now, and I knew, again, it would take a year or maybe more to make, I had the urge to do something really quick. And so I talked to a core group of musicians. I said, look, I've got this bunch of songs that I want to do. I want to knock them out. And we did that album in a week. So, you know, it was like we do kind of, you know, it was kind of like doing a song or two a day.
Yeah.
And at the end of the week, this is very old school. I mean, this is like, you know, this is like the Beatles made an album or, you know, Dylan made it. You know, you would just go in and say, okay, we're going to do two songs today. Here are the two songs. This is what we're going to do. Here's the keyboard. You know, what do you think you're going to do? Okay, that sounds good. What are the drummer? Okay, this is what you're going to do. And we would, you know, nothing was more than a couple of takes. And at the end of the week, that was the album. No matter what was on there, you know, succeed or fail, that was those were the tracks. So, so that was kind of the impetus was more an artistic expression than it was an homage to Elvis, but I did feel that the songs owed an inspirational debt to him because they do have a sort of flavor of his to them. And I think it's, you know, if you're inspired by a particular artist, you should, you know, you should say it. And
yes, kudos and credit.
You know,
absolutely.
It's not that he inspires me more than, you know, the Beatles or the Small Faces or Bob Dylan or any artist that I, or Roy Orbison for that matter. But in that moment and in that group of 10 or 12 songs, he was the preeminent sort of inspiration. And I think, you know, it also too, Angie, I have to say, it's like, you know, if you mention these musicians I play with or the artists I'm inspired by, it brings people to the project who wouldn't otherwise maybe be interested. In other words, if people see it advertised and they say, oh, this guy's inspired by Elvis Costello, I like Elvis Costello, they give it a chance. And I think the hardest
yes.
thing in this day and age is to get people to take a chance.
Yes, I agree. I think you're absolutely right. Would you give us a nice lead-in on My Dolly?
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, My Dolly is from the first – My Dolly is – I think the version you're going to play is from the first Badge album. I had recorded it, and Pete Townsend had produced it, and with his touring band. And then Simon, his brother, Simon Townsend, and I co-wrote the song. And when it came – and I never liked the recording. And when it came time to make the first Badge album, I kept – Simon's parts and I kept the keyboard player's parts, but all the rest of it is the Badge playing. And it, you know, it's a song I wrote. I was traveling. I was in Oxford, England at the time. It was a beautiful day, You know, similarly, it was kind of an Elvis Costello inspiration. It's like I wanted to write a love song, but I didn't want to write a love song. So how do you write a love song? You write a love song about an inflatable doll. So hence the My Dolly and some of the quirky lyrics. And you know, it turned out okay. And I don't think Simon ever knew that's what the lyrics were about. He kind of helped more with the music. But it was, you know, it was like, you know, how do you approach – how many times can you say, I love you, baby, to whoever is the person sitting next to you? Well, I'm going to tell you, when you're not here, I'm not going to cheat on you, but there's this other thing in the closet, and that's what I'm going to write about right now. So that's what My Dolly was about, and it's had a long life. You know, I've performed that song probably more than any other song of mine, and I have a real love for it, too.
I can't wait. Here we go, everybody.
All right.
Can we book you to come back before you do the big shows? And We're just, I'm so excited to have had a chance to meet you. Thank you, Rick, for introducing me to Jeff.
I'd love to come back. I'm you know, there'll be a lot to talk about with the new album, and I'm sure a lot will have happened in the intervening months, and I'd love to do this. It's really fun. And I like I liked how you were a little breathless when the song ended. That's always great as a songwriter.
Well, yes, it was. It was just absolutely wonderful. And I can't, well, you've been so kind indulging us or indulging me about Roy Orbison and Elvis. I just sometimes, you know, you want to have someone that knows answer those questions for you. And so I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Sure.
So Jeff,
well, I do like to see. I like to keep some things mysterious, but that I was happy to share.
And well, I'm a visual person, so I'm going to have fun with my dolly.
There you
oh,
go.
Yes, I bet you are. So, Jeff, have you got a message for the audience? And we'll have to say our adieus because time's run out. I can't.
Sure,
believe it.
They
we
should.
Just started.
They should find. They should find me on the internet at jeffslate.net. They can also find me on Facebook, Jeff Slate or Jeff Slate HQ, Twitter, Jeff Slate. You know, I'm pretty much anywhere on the internet. I'm Jeff Slate. You know, that's my handle, as they say. And you know, feel free to reach out to me. I'm pretty accessible, and I usually try to answer any messages I get. And you know, I like to talk to people who are music fans. As much as an artist, you know, I'm a fan. I think any artist really is. And if the person is sincere and smart and really, you know, eager to find out what you think or, you know, about your music or about what you think about somebody else's music, that's always fun. It's always fun for any artist to do. So,
yes, I agree.
You know, I'm game, you know. And that's the great thing about the internet and shows like this is you know you're available to people, and they do tend to reach out to you. I mean, that's how you know, as disconnected as we are in this strange technological world, we're even more connected, and that's kind of cool.
Yes, it is.
You're right.
And from your mouth to our audience's ears, we are all more connected than we actually realize technology can be used, and you can design your career like Jeff Slate did. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Angie, Jeff.
And thanks, Rick. It was a pleasure.
Oh, I'm glad you were here.
Bye-bye.
That was awesome. Bye, Angie.
Bye,
thank you. Thank you,
thank
listeners.
You. Bye.